Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're beginning with a conflict that appears to be running at two different paces. On the battlefield, the war between Russia and Ukraine has, for a time now, appeared to be slow, grinding. On the diplomatic and strategic level, though, things appear to be developing, changing at a breathless pace. Overnight in Washington, there was the latest thunderbolt from the Trump administration, an announcement that it was suspending US military aid to Ukraine. A few hours ago, out of Kiev, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tried, via the social media platform X, to repair some of the damage wrought in that disastrous Oval Office confrontation on Friday. None of us wants an endless war, he began. One of the NewsHour team has voiced up some of his subsequent message.
We do really value how much America has done to help Ukraine maintain its sovereignty and independence. And we remember the moment when things changed, when President Trump provided Ukraine with javelins. We are grateful for this. Our meeting in Washington at the White House on Friday did not go the way it was supposed to be. It is regrettable that it happened this way. It is time to make things right. We would like future cooperation and communication to be constructive.
The words of Volodymyr Zelensky. The overnight order from Donald Trump to suspend military aid sounds all-encompassing. But what detail do we have on what precisely has been affected by this order and what it will mean for the Ukrainians' ability to fight this war? Jonathan Beale is the BBC's defence correspondent.
We're talking about equipment, ammunition, which the US has supplied to Ukraine in large amounts. Now, I think at the beginning of the war, Ukraine was not completely, but mainly reliant on US military support. Since then, Europe has stepped up, for example, its production of 155 artillery shells. It's producing more than a million shells a year. But essentially, that hardware is not going through the border. That's according to Polish authorities. They have noticed that the flow of ammunition, flow of weapons from the US has now slowed down. We're never clear about the Trump administration, whether it was continuing to supply weapons. I think we know the answer was yes now, but they never went into detail about what they were supplying beyond what President Biden had supplied. But we know what Ukraine has been very, very reliant on, and that is what one Western official calls the cream of Western weaponry, which is Patriot batteries, air defense systems which have been protecting Ukraine cities and which are one of the few air defense systems that can take down ballistic missiles, and then the long-range weaponry such as HIMARS, ATACMS, which Ukraine has been using to hit high-value targets inside Russian-occupied territory of Ukraine.
There has been, beyond that, discussion as to whether strategic intelligence could be affected, and also whether it's not directly out of the Pentagon, but, you know, the satellite communication system that's delivered by Elon Musk's company, Starlink, whether that could be affected. Have there been any, I mean, you said it's sometimes difficult to get all this information, but any rumblings on that?
So we don't know how far, how deep it is, and what exactly it applies to in the sense of when it comes to that military-to-military relationship that exists between, and to be honest, which is probably pretty close. I would imagine that it will be hard to break up that military-to-military relationship. And if you are a senior military officer providing information to Ukraine at the moment, you will not probably stop unless you are specifically told to. So we do not know whether the Trump administration has asked that to be stopped. What we do know is that Starlink, as you mentioned, which they use not just to communicate with each other on the front line to their families back home, but also for targeting of drones and artillery, that they have been essential. And we do know the Pentagon, after Elon Musk had a wobble, he did provide Starlink dishes at the start of the war. His position on the war has changed gradually. He's now, of course, part of a Trump administration, which appears to be very hostile to President Zelensky. We do know the Pentagon did fund that for a while, and one would assume that if they did fund it, and if they are pausing military aid to Ukraine, that might be affected, but we don't know for sure.
Lots of people are saying that, you know, if this pause extends and, you know, Europe has said there's been lots of proclamations today that, you know, Europe will do all it can to step into the breach, that will take time. Could a workaround potentially be, if Europe can somehow get the money together, for Europe to purchase this US weaponry and send it to Ukraine itself?
I mean, Trump is a transactional politician. And if Europe is willing to spend money inside America, it would be odd for Donald Trump to say no. But we don't know whether that the pause affects European nations buying American kit, essentially. We do know that when European nations wanted to give Ukraine F-16 jets from their air force, that the US did have to approve that. We don't know the detail of how deep this pause is and how much it affects. We know it affects hardware, ammunition, the stuff that you can touch and feel. We're not so sure about the stuff that goes under the radar, if you like.
The BBC's defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale. As we heard at the start of the programme, the Ukrainian president has put out a message pouring gratitude on the US for its role so far, on President Trump for what he described as his strong leadership, and expressing his regret for the Oval Office bust-up. The White House, for its part, continues to insist that it just wants to bring a ruinous war to a swift conclusion. What's the Democrats' response to all this? Congressman Steny Hoyer is the most senior member of the Democratic group in the House of Representatives.
The effect is obviously negative for the Ukrainians, negative to their morale and to their confidence. Secondly, it's negative in the sense that it gives Putin and the aggressor and the war criminal some sense that he is getting the advantage. And from that standpoint, I think that very, very disappointing that we've had a delay. So the pause at this point in time simply continues that sense of unsureness of where the United States will be going.
Except as far as the Trump administration is concerned, as far as Mr. Trump is concerned, I mean, if we go from his public pronouncements on all this, he says he wants to bring an end to this war. He says he also wants a deal to be done with Ukraine over the right to extract minerals. And he also wants Ukraine to show a bit of gratitude for all the help that it has been given so far. On that, well, I mean, I hear you titter in the background, but on that, I mean, the message on social media today from Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, has basically said, I agree with you on all those issues. This is a suspension of military aid. It doesn't mean that, you know, necessarily that America is going to turn off the tap forever.
I agree with that.
Well, in that case, I mean, you could argue that President Trump has got what he wanted. He came into office with a clear mandate, which was, I mean, he had said all along, I want this war to an end. He's trying to hurry that along.
Well, when you say he's trying to hurry it along, he's trying to hurry it along to the great advantage of the aggressor, Russia, ceding much of the territory of Ukraine, including Crimea, to the aggressor and to the person that moved in into Crimea, unfortunately with only minimum response from the West, which I think is the mother of this war. And I've said that. Crimea, the failure to respond effectively in Crimea, gave Putin the opinion that the West would not respond. I think he was very surprised at the West's response. And I think that's why the Ukrainians have been able to, with the first instance, the courage and commitment they've shown to defending their homeland, but obviously with the help of the West. And of course, the president has been wrong in the assertion that the United States has been the primary funder. It's been certainly as a country the primary funder, but Europeans have really given more in the sense of financial resources and weapons purchased than the United States. The pause here is unfortunate in the context in which it's being made because it reaffirms the message that somehow we're going to put financial pressure on Zelensky and Ukraine to force them to make a deal that is not in their best interest.
And yet, I mean, again, one of the effects of this is that Europe has made declaration after declaration in the past few days saying that we will put in hundreds of billions of dollars into defence expenditure, both for the protection of the continent, but also in terms of trying to help Ukraine as far as possible. Again, that's something that I would have thought there would be fairly broad support for in the US. I mean, you know, and indeed among your, you know your constituents far better than me, but I mean, you know, I would imagine that if you were to ask members of the American public, are you pleased that the burden is being shared more widely, they would say yes.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that. You're absolutely correct. I think what Zelensky had to say today was a positive message, although I think it's unfortunate that he had to give that message because he was put in a corner, bullied, if you will, into having to say he's thankful. Obviously, he's thankful. He said that repeatedly. But frankly, we all remember that Trump was impeached because he tried to make a deal with Zelensky for his own political purposes that Zelensky courageously said, I don't want to be involved in this. And I think the president still holds that against him. And that's sad because this fight is our fight as well as Ukraine's fight. This fight is Europe's fight as well as our fight. This is the free world's fight in which children have been kidnapped and taken to Russia. Thousands of people have been killed. Residents have been attacked by Russia, and it is the sole perpetrator of the aggression. And in that context, I think it's wise for Europe to have stepped up to the plate. I think Americans will appreciate them stepping up to the plate. I hope the president appreciates that as well. But frankly, I think it's in Europe's best interest to step up to the plate. But I also think it's in America's best interest to continue the assistance that we've given over the past 3 years.
And that was the Democratic Congressman Steny Hoyer speaking to me, and he was speaking to me ahead of a speech by Donald Trump later on today, Washington time, to the to both houses of Congress. And the Reuters news agency has a line which it says Trump has told advisers he wants to announce the Ukraine minerals deal during that speech to Congress, according to sources that they've been speaking to. It's just on the Reuters news agency, but a suggestion that Donald Trump keen to move along that minerals deal with Ukraine. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up on the programme, we'll hear from one of the UK's most exciting and currently most loved bands.
If you want to know kind of like the bread and butter of how Ezra Collective were formed, it is supportive parents that believed in music, great schools that nourished and taught music, and then this youth club that kind of honed us together and told us it was all possible.
The recipe, according to the Ezra Collective, more from them in 30 minutes. Our headlines this hour, as we've been hearing, Volodymyr Zelensky has said he's prepared to work under what he called Donald Trump's strong leadership to secure a lasting peace after the US cut military aid to Ukraine. And Canada's Prime Minister has fiercely condemned Mr. Trump's new tariffs on Canadian products, accusing him of seeking the neighbouring country's economic collapse and its annexation. We'll be hearing about the effects on global markets in 25 minutes. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London. A leader of the M23 rebels, who have swept through the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, say that they are ready to go all the way to the capital, Kinshasa, should they come under attack from government forces. Kone Nonga, who heads an alliance which includes the M23, claims they're liberators defending themselves against the government. Many nations, and indeed the United Nations, say that the M23 is backed by neighbouring Rwanda. Rwanda denies backing the rebel fighters who now control Goma and Bukavu, the two largest cities in the mineral-rich east. The UN says almost 3,000 people lost their lives in the battle to capture Goma in late January. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, has been speaking to Corné Nonga in Goma. What's his response to that death toll from the United Nations?
I have not seen the 3,000 people. You know, Goma is a small city. I know that they were fighting in the city. But it's amazing to see that in a city like Goma, 3,000 people was killed. I don't know. But I don't see the family who are mourning.
But families have been in the morgue. Families have been collecting bodies.
And when you see the population, how they welcomed us, it's just amazing.
Just to be clear, are you saying that 3,000 people were not killed here?
No, I don't. This is a lie.
Are you planning to continue your advance, to continue pushing forward and taking control of more territory?
Depending on Kinshasa. So far as they will attack us, and then we will defend ourselves.
So you say you will only respond if you are being attacked?
We respond and we take away the threats.
But you have also said you will go all the way to Kinshasa.
So if the threat is in Kinshasa, we'll go there.
What are your relations with Rwanda? UN experts say there are up to 4,000 troops here from Rwanda fighting with you, that they train the M23, they arm the M23, they have effective control over the M23.
I don't know anything about Rwanda. If they say that there are 4,000 fighters from Rwanda, I don't know, I didn't see them. But for me, we have a Congolese problem. I am a Congolese man. I believe that our problem is to be sorted out, not by other countries, but by Congolese themselves.
Are you saying that there are no Rwandan troops here and you have no connection with Rwanda?
Saying that I don't have connection with Rwanda, I would lie. You see the border? You cannot live in Goma without Rwanda, and Rwanda can never live without Goma.
So you don't receive any assistance from Rwanda?
I don't see the military assistance from Rwanda.
So even though there is photographic evidence of Rwandan troops here in DRC, you say they are not here and not fighting with you?
They can have their evidence. Me, I say that I don't have those evidence. We have our own reason why we are fighting.
And you're not being helped by Rwanda?
I don't know. I'm not talking about Rwanda. I'm no Rwandese.
Is there a plan to try to join the east of Congo to Rwanda?
Never. We remain Congolese. A Congo is going to remain the same country. No Balkanization is not in our agenda at all.
Human rights groups have accused the M23 over the past few years of a whole range of abuses, of systematic shelling, of mass rape, of killing of civilians. They say this has been carried out by M23 fighters, and they have documented these cases. What's your response?
I didn't see the report. I cannot respond for the report that I didn't read.
Are you not worried about these allegations?
No,
they've been made for years.
No, I've never read those allegations. And also, we are also writing our own report for all these issues.
If a body like the UN or the Red Cross or Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, if all of these people are saying the M23 is carrying out human rights abuses, do you not wish to look into that?
No, I think they are not the right people to make reports on this kind of issue. And for the other reports, I've not read them.
But these reports have been made over years. Why have you not read them until now?
Give me one, then I will be reading it.
I can send you many.
Please, appreciate.
Do you want to be the next president of Congo?
This is not our aim. Our aim is to fight against corruption. We are fighting because there are people who are denied their citizenship. We have our reason why we are fighting. This is the reason. Our objective is not to become the president.
Congolese rebel leader Corné Nonga speaking to Orla Guerin. The other side of this vast country in the northwest of the DRC, at least 53 people are reported to have died from unknown causes. The illness, which appears to claim lives within a day of symptoms appearing, last month spread through Basankusu, a village in Equateur province. The World Health Organization is investigating the outbreak, and Dr. Margaret Harris is a spokeswoman for the WHO.
One of the things that concerned us was the first cases in the initial cluster were disproportionately young adolescents and young adults, and mostly males. And this is one group of people that, no matter where you are, don't normally die very suddenly from something that could be an infection. They basically die from violence, but they don't normally just get sick and die within 24 hours. And we had seen this with this group. You know, they were reporting a very rapid time from onset of symptoms to death. And we've also seen a rapid decline in the number of reported deaths. And so the working hypothesis is that it's most likely to be either poisoning of some kind, environmental poisoning or pesticide poisoning, or the other thing it could be is bacterial meningitis, because that can kill very quickly, and it does kill teenagers and young adults quite quickly too.
Right. I suppose the poisoning hypothesis, though, you know, you would then get into, I mean, obviously it would be sort of what is causing the poisoning, but why these... this particular group of people were so susceptible to it.
Exactly. So one of the first things we did was send up epidemiologists, because they are, just like journalists, they are people who take detailed history about who did what where, and they don't just rely on one source. They go and talk to everyone. The other thing they do, and we've done field investigations, taking environmental samples and sent them off for toxicological analysis. We don't have that back. The other thing we also did was do spinal taps to see if it's meningitis.
If it's not meningitis, I mean, what are the chances? How unusual would it be if this were somehow the first instance of a brand new disease?
Well, indeed, that's why we send up our experts and do this surveillance whenever we hear what we call a signal. And if it's something unusual, it's something that's causing severe illness and death, we go up there and investigate.
In terms of the monitoring that you do, and also, I guess, just the work that you do more generally, can you tell me how far it is already being affected by the decision by the Trump administration to disengage from the World Health Organization, and also more broadly the sort of the clampdown on the amount of foreign aid that the US provides?
Well, certainly funding is always a challenge, but the US has been critical. I mean, the US is a very, very generous donor in the most fragile countries in the world, including the Democratic Republic of Congo. They also provide expertise. So, you know, you will always find the CDC very much involved in outbreak responses and working on surveillance and working on community outreach and all the really critical things that make a difference in outbreak response. So any withdrawal of that support does leave the world at risk, because these people who do this work, who do the surveillance every day in the most remote communities, they are the eyes and ears of the rest of the world.
And that was Margaret Harris from the World Health Organization. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. In Australia, tributes have been paid to a prolific blood donor who's died at the age of 88. It's thought the blood plasma donated by James Harrison saved around 2.4 million babies. Mr. Harrison had a rare blood type that contained an antibody known as anti-D. The antibody is given to a woman whose own immune system attacks the red blood cells of her unborn child's. Mr. Harrison donated every fortnight for decades. The Australian Red Cross Blood Service called him the man with the golden arm. Here he is speaking almost a decade ago.
It becomes quite humbling when they say, oh, you've done this or you've done that, or you're a hero. No, no, no. I said, it's something I can do. You know? It's one of my talents. Probably my only talent is that I can be a blood donor.
NewsHour's Rebecca Kesby has been hearing more about this remarkable man from his grandson, Jared Mellowship.
Oh, he was just a hard working, nice bloke. Always looked after us. He just made sure he donated his blood every 2 weeks, and that's it. Loved his travelling, but even when he was travelling, he had to donate his blood.
How did he do that when he was on the road?
He would find a blood bank no matter where he was. I know every winter he would go to Queensland for 3 months because it's warmer up there, up in the tropic, and he found a blood bank at Maroochydore, and he'd go there every 2 weeks. And he'd time it so that he could always donate no matter where he was.
And, I mean, this does sound as if this was a thing that he took incredibly seriously.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Wouldn't give it up for anything. he just felt like he had to give back to, you know, the cause that kind of saved his life. I think he had a lung removed when he was 14. And in that surgery, he took a whole heap of blood. And that's what they believe, or from what I know, has created this thing he's got in his blood, or had in his blood, because he took in a whole heap of different blood types when he had this transfusion. So that was when he was 14. So he swore that when he turned 18, he would start donating blood back. And then as it progressed, they found he had this special stuff, and here we are today.
I understand he also donated to your mother for your birth. Is that right?
Yeah. Mum had to have the injection so then I could have a brother. So then Scott was born. And then Mum had another injection with Scott in case they had another baby but didn't.
And since he passed away, lots of people have been paying tributes to him, including many of the people whose lives he effectively saved.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Everyone's kind of not coming out of the woodworks, but how, you know, this injection was able to create their babies and all that kind of stuff. And without that, they, you know, might not have had children and families quite similar to my family. My wife had to have the injection 3 times so that we could have our 4 kids.
Really? Goodness
so,
me.
Yeah.
Quite a legacy then.
Yeah, no, it's pretty humbling. No, he was just a man set in his ways. Nothing would stop him from donating. Love the attention from the nurses. He's a little bit of a flirty bloke with them.
Right.
You know, he's a little cheeky, but he was all right. It was all harmless. He's good. Good egg.
You must be very proud of him.
Oh, of course. Of course. But he's just granddad to us.
Jared Mellowship. Charming interviews. Talking to Rebecca Kesby. You're with the BBC World Service, and I'm Tim Franks with NewsHour. It's coming to you live from London. It may feel at the moment as if Donald Trump is setting the pace with game-changing decisions on Ukraine, on tariffs. We'll come to those a little bit later. And also with Israel and Gaza. But today there's been an attempt on the last issue, at least, Gaza, in other words, to wrest back the initiative by a group of leading Arab countries. They've been meeting in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, to come up with an alternative to President Trump's idea of somehow emptying the enclave of 2 million-plus Gazans. And also something that might perhaps go some way to meeting Israeli security demands. The other potentially important element in all this is what the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who currently just still holds some control in the West Bank, has had to say about his future, given that he's 89 years old and, according to the opinion polls, very unpopular. Well, the meeting did end with a plan, and our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucet, who's in Cairo, told me more about what's been proposed.
There's a lot in this plan. As you mentioned, it's essentially a plan put together under great pressure to prove to President Donald Trump that his property development plan, which would involve, in his words, taking over the Gaza Strip, moving out more than 2 million Palestinians and developing what he calls a Riviera of the Middle East, is not the only plan. Now, we have just heard at the press conference which brought this summit to a close that the Egypt plan, which was put on the table, is now an Arab plan. Crucially, it's a plan which says we can rebuild Gaza. We can do it in 5 years, not the 10 to 15 years President Trump was talking about. And we can do it without displacing the Palestinians. They can remain in the Gaza Strip while this three-phase plan unfolds. And, of course, it is a plan which is going to cost a huge amount of money. Estimates say some $53 billion. And so the Arab summit has said they're going to hold a major international conference to try to start raising the funds necessary. There's also detail on these very sensitive, explosive issues, really, on who runs Gaza when the war ends. Well, it's not a new idea, but they put some more details on it. It would be a Gaza Technical Committee composed of a small group, about 20 qualified technocrats, and it would be under the umbrella of what they call the Palestinian government, in other words, the Palestinian Authority, run by Mahmoud Abbas. And it glosses over that really difficult, dangerous issue of, well, what about Hamas?
Lise, just on that, and we don't have a huge amount of time, unfortunately, but Mahmoud Abbas, what he had to say about changes to the way in which he runs things. What's the significance there?
Well, there are always many elephants in the room, and one of them is, what about Mahmoud Abbas? He's become increasingly unpopular, and now he's saying that he's ready to hold elections and ready to appoint a vice president. The first signs that he's ready to really share power.
Lisa Set, speaking to me from Cairo. Meanwhile, in Gaza, the World Health Organization says that at least 12,000 sick and wounded Palestinians still need immediate evacuation. And it's not just life-saving treatment needed. UN officials estimate that 30,000 people have life-changing injuries that will require years of rehabilitation. Among them is 9-year-old Rami, who did manage to get out. He arrived in Jordan last month at a Doctors Without Borders hospital, from where the BBC's Caroline Hawley now reports.
In the physiotherapy room here, there are patients pushing through their pain and discomfort, desperate to try to get something of their former lives back. It's a bright and cheery room, sunlight pouring through the windows, but everyone here has been through really dark times. The youngest of them here now is Rami. He's just 9, and his legs were really badly injured by shrapnel from an Israeli airstrike last summer in Gaza. It killed his older brother.
We were sleeping, and then they bombed our neighbour's house.
Rami is here with his physiotherapist, Zaid. He's put aside his red, blue and green crutches.
He supports Cristiano Ronaldo, so he wants to play football like him. This is the first time for me let him to play football. So for me, it's a very nice moment, actually.
Rami's with the nurse now, having the dressings on his legs changed. He's had one operation since he arrived at MSF's Specialised Hospital for Reconstructive Surgery, which treats victims of war from around the Middle East. It hurts, he says, but it's nothing like the agony he suffered during surgery in Gaza, with no painkillers and no antibiotics. His wounds were so infected they had maggots in them, and doctors said both legs would have to be amputated. Many more rounds of surgery lie ahead.
In Gaza, before the war, we used to have medical treatment, but then the aid stopped.
He lists his surviving brothers and father still in Gaza, and then breaks down, remembering 12-year-old Mustafa, who's no longer there.
I see him in my dreams, laughing and happy.
Mustafa's mum, Islam, accompanied Rami to Jordan, hard as it was to leave Gaza.
My heart is in Gaza. My soul is in Gaza. Despite what happened in Gaza, I love it. I just want to get Rami treated here and then go back there.
Rami's getting more mobile now on his crutches, one of 13 Palestinian children being treated here. But the World Health Organization says thousands of others need to be brought out of Gaza because the health system has collapsed. The MSF hospital's director, Roshan Kumarasamy, says it's able to provide just a drop in the ocean of need.
Any point on the unimaginable massive spectrum of injuries you can ever conjure up in your mind, it's all there. In the thousands, people will be doing reconstructive surgery for Gaza patients for years to come, and their psychological aspect, some will never recover.
Rami's dad in Gaza has his brother Aboud on his lap, tickling him to try to cheer him up. Aboud is 8 years old and one of many, many amputees. He lost his lower right leg and has crutches to walk on, but no prosthetic yet. When the Israeli military allowed Rami and his mum to leave Gaza in January, Aboud and his dad weren't able to go too.
Hi, Rami. Habibi.
They've been keeping in touch as much as they can by phone, and sometimes there's been just enough signal for a blurry video call. Rami tells his family he misses them and wants to show his dad how he can now get up by himself and stand on his own 2 feet. You're strong, his father tells him. You're a hero. And today, another reason for the family to cheer. The Israeli authorities have just allowed Rami's brother and their father to leave Gaza for Jordan so that Aboud can get treatment too.
And that was Caroline Hawley reporting from Jordan. Tuesday has been
Tariff Day, 25% taxes on imports from Canada and Mexico into the US, 20% on imports from China into the US. All three countries have promised to impose retaliatory tariffs on imports from the United States. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau quoted a right-of-centre newspaper in the US to hit back at President Trump's decision.
Now, it's not in my habit to agree with the Wall Street Journal, but Donald, they point out that even though you're a very smart guy, this is a very dumb thing to do. We two friends fighting is exactly what our opponents around the world want to see.
For his part, President Trump has warned that any retaliatory tariffs will be met by another hike from the US in the level of tariffs that it is imposing. Agathe Desmarais is Senior Policy Fellow in Geoeconomics at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Given that Mr. Trump had warned all along this was precisely what he was planning, how much of a shock has today been to the global trading system?
It is definitely a shock, especially for Canada and Mexico, because these two economies are deeply intertwined with the US economy. Financial markets have reacted very strongly, and this shows that private firms will be the ones actually feeling the burden of the tariffs, because at the end of the day, tariffs are a tax that US importers will need to pay on their imports. And of course, this is going to hurt bottom lines, and there is a high chance that private firms will pass on the higher costs to consumers, fueling inflation. So that's definitely going to be a hit to the US economy.
What's your assessment of how quickly this might feed through to people's behaviours?
Private firms are increasingly worried about the impact of tariffs on their activities. And I'm talking here about US firms. So in the short run, we will definitely see these effects. And I think that something that is also really striking is the level of uncertainty. It's very hard to keep track of what is happening at the moment. And this uncertainty will weigh on employment, on investment. So this impact will be felt in the short run. And then the inflationary impact of US firms passing on the costs to consumers will probably be felt in maybe 9 to 12 months.
One other thing that some people are raising is whether these threats and this imposition of tariffs in some cases is going to change the way in which countries do trade, that in a sense they will try and organize themselves to circumvent or cut out the United States. Is that just wishful thinking, or do you think we could begin to see that?
This would be extremely difficult for several reasons. The sheer size, of course, of the US economy, the largest economy in the world, makes it very difficult to simply avoid the US market. One option is, of course, to invest in the US and to open production lines in the US. And that's essentially what Trump is saying. But would you open a production line in the US for just 4 years of Trump? Would it make sense from a rational economic financial perspective? This is not entirely clear. So I think that many US firms and firms in general from all around the world will say that these will be 4 very difficult years, but there is no easy option to dodge the impact of US tariffs.
And in terms of governmental responses, you have described, certainly, you know, you hear lots of economists describing this as an act of self-harm by the Trump administration because it will raise prices in the United States. We've heard it from Justin Trudeau today. We've got it from Beijing that they will impose retaliatory tariffs themselves on US produce. You can understand the politics, but is that potentially an act of self-harm by the same argument for those countries?
Absolutely. I think there is some sort of schizophrenia in the responses from US trading partners, because on the one hand, taking a look, for instance, at EU declarations, we see very clearly that EU leaders, but also Canadian leaders, all say that tariffs are going to harm the US economy. So to me, it is very striking to hear the second half of this sentence is, and we will retaliate with just the same poison. At least from an economic perspective, it would probably make much more sense to acknowledge the fact that US tariffs will harm US firms and consumers first and foremost. And it does not mean that US trading partners must go down the same route. Even politically, any country that believes that retaliatory tariffs are going to stop Trump's actions, I think this is a very difficult bet to make.
Agathe Desmarais from the European Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to NewsHour.
Well, it's great to have you with us here on the BBC World Service. Coming up at 23 GMT, Hard Talk is joined by the Chinese dissident artist Badiou Cao.
As an artist, we have to pay very attention to our life and be truthful to our experience. That is why I would always focusing on those political events or human rights record from China, because that's the thing that I care the most.
And that's followed by The Conversation and this week, the joy and responsibility of being a foster carer.
So I really like the concept of just being a bonus parent to someone who is in a state of vulnerability.
And then we join Max Pearson for the History Hour.
Inuit children forced to move from Greenland to Denmark in the 1950s. Mixed-race children kidnapped under colonial rule in the then Belgian Congo. Plus a massacre in India and a tsunami in Chile.
But now let's rejoin NewsHour and Tim Franks.
This is NewsHour, live from London. Russians who sign up to fight in Ukraine earn big money in salaries and bonuses, and the money paid out by the Kremlin to the families of those killed in battle is even higher, more than $100,000. In less wealthy Russian provinces, where most recruits are from, that's enough to turn fortunes around. The BBC's Arseniy Sokolov has been meeting relatives of dead Russian soldiers to find out how they've been spending their money.
Andrei Nazarenko was 21 when he was killed fighting for Russia in Ukraine. At his old school in small town in the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains of southern Russia, they solemnly unveiled a desk in his memory. He was a qualified chef, and when he called his mother Oksana from the front, he talked of using those skills when he got back.
He used to say, "Mom, let's open a cafe together. It'll be great."
Now, though she's still grieving bitterly, Oksana's fulfilled his dream without him. She's opened a cozy little restaurant in his memory.
We do lots of different cuisines. European, Caucasian, and my signature dish? Well, I do lagman.
A rich noodle dish with meat, vegetables and spices. The business employs several people. Oksana couldn't have started it without the compensation money from the state. The average payout is about 14 million rubles. That's nearly $160,000. All over Russia, families of the fallen are using the money to buy property and rise up the social ladder. Economist Vladislav Naziemtsev calls it deathonomics.
If someone signs up to the army at the age of 35 from not the most wealthy Russian regions, gets the regional payment for the signature of the contract, serves there 6 to 8 months and is killed, and all the compensations are paid to his family, it would be definitely bigger sum of money than he could earn till the end of his active life at the age of 65.
You could buy a whole village on the proceeds from one man's death.
That's lawyer and human rights defender Nadezhda Nizovkina, speaking from Buryatia on the Mongolian border. It's a poor, remote region that's provided a disproportionately high number of men to fight and die in Ukraine. But she says the newly acquired compensation money isn't always very visible.
Many people now are scared to flaunt their wealth, because showing you got rich on spilled blood, it means you or your relative didn't sign up out of high moral principles.
The Kremlin is determined that those who return alive from the front line will be treated as heroes. Vladimir Putin has even launched a scheme to fast-track selected veterans into leadership positions in local administration and businesses. The real elite, he says, are those who serve Russia, loyal workers and warriors. Existing local elites often resist admitting newcomers, but compensation payments have certainly catapulted a huge number of Russian families into a higher social class. If, according to rough but informed estimates, 150,000 Russian soldiers have died in Ukraine, and if each of their families has actually received what they're due, that would mean the state has spent the equivalent of more than 2% of federal expenditure on such payouts over the past 3 years.
And that was the BBC's Arseny Sokolov reporting. Now, for something a little bit cooler and a lot more edifying than usual. The Sound of No One's Watching Me by Ezra Collective. It's from their latest album. The multi-award winners in Britain, they won Best British Group at the weekend's Brit Awards. They've just returned from their first very successful tour of South America. The band formed more than a decade ago when they met at a youth club in London. But these days, with so much pressure on public finances, is there less chance of the next generation of bands coming through in a similar way? Femi Colioso is the band leader of Ezra Collective, and he's been speaking to my colleague Sarah Montague.
If you want to know kind of like the bread and butter of how Ezra Collective were formed, it is supportive parents that believed in music, great schools that nourished and taught music, and then this youth club that kind of honed us together and told us it was all possible. When I went to this youth club, in particular Tomorrow's Warriors, I'd get the train up to the South Bank and there was a room in the basement. There was a drum kit, there was a piano, and there was just chairs in a circle. I'd walk in, some of my friends would have trumpets and saxophones, clarinets, and I'd just sit on the drum kit, and one of the teachers would be like, let's learn this song today, and we'd all try and learn it and have like a bit of a jam session. In between playing, we'd run off to McDonald's, get some nuggets or whatever, but it was all centred around, let's just sit down in a circle and play some songs together.
So, and how old were you then?
I started when I was 15.
If you hadn't gone to the youth club, what do you think would have happened?
Well, I know what wouldn't have happened. A Brit Award wouldn't have happened on Saturday because that dream was implanted in that youth club. There's a lot of negative things that can dwell on an idle mind. I'm not going to make out like, oh yeah, I would have been in a gang and I would have done X, Y and Z, because that probably wouldn't have been the narrative. But irrespective of that, it put a dream in my head that was like, yeah, music is totally possible and it's there for you. And like I said, an idle mind and boredom for a teenager can be a dangerous combination. And youth clubs eradicate that and end up giving people a dream and a future.
Does the school that you went to today, does it have as much musical instruments and its ability to provide music as it did when you were there?
I think what they have is teachers that are very passionate and very loyal and very caring. But by way of the actual resources, it's very, very thin. It's a make-do thing. You know, one of my teachers just made the joke to me, like, all they need is gaffer tape and they'll make it work.
As far as the youth club is concerned, is it just about creating a space because then the community will make it happen?
I think so. I think so. I think there's enough people willing and enough people with the heart to help young people, enough people that understand its importance, that if the space is created and a little bit of funding, suddenly you've got somewhere that can be of such deep importance.
I mean, you're talking about, what, 10 years ago? When, I mean, social media was a thing then, it's more now. Do you see that in, you know, when you're looking at youngsters today, is that idea that they're spending more time online than they are face-to-face with friends?
Yeah, for sure, that's the reality of it. But at the same time, I feel like those moments online are a side effect of having nothing else to do. But even working at a youth club right now, I know if there's a football match going on and they've got a ball and two goalposts, none of them are on their phones. There's nothing inherently wrong with social media, but there's so much great things that can come away from your phone, you know?
Femi Colioso, drummer from the Ezra Collective, and one of the genuinely lovely people in show business. He was speaking to my colleague Sarah Montague and ending this edition of NewsHour. From all of us here in London, thanks for your company.